Talking politics to real people, it's Bondi Tunes International.
This is Bondi Tunes International, broadcasting around the world, and we welcome our listeners on FM in Canberra, Australia, and Wellington, New Zealand. I'm Henry in Sydney, and I'm delighted to have our Australian political correspondent, Adam Devlin, on the line from Brisbane in the state of Queensland. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Henry. Hello, listeners.
Now, at the first Tuesday of every month in Australia, the Reserve Bank tells us usually bad news about interest rates. This is the 12th time they've been lifted here in Australia. They rose 0.25% to 4.1%. Highest in 11 years, Adam. What about that?
Yeah, it's absolutely appalling. I've got some very strong opinions on this, Henry.
Yes, please do tell.
And of course, the opinions aren't necessarily around the interest rise that happened today of 0.25 percentage points. That was not really a surprise, I don't think, to many people. Mm. But my issue is with Philip Lowe, the head of the Reserve Bank of Australia, who came out last year and did say to the Australian population that interest rates would not rise until 2025. Mm-hmm. Now, here we are in 2023, and we've had now 11 or 12?
It's 12. This is rises, the 12th today, yeah.
In 13 months. So there are a whole range of people in the Australian mortgage market at the moment that only are there because they believed that when the head of the Reserve Bank said that it would be 2 to 3 years before interest rates would start rising, that they had that opportunity of time.
They made plans.
To invest in something with a certain sense of predictability that they could afford these investments or the home that they were buying based on the fact that it would be a couple of years before rates started to rise. And in that time, they could get themselves into a situation whereby they would be able to cope with some small rises. And then he's raised them, 12 times in 13 months.
Yes. Talking about the number 11, it's the highest in 11 years, actually, Adam.
Yeah. The economy is the economy, so it is what it is.
Just to explain inflation, people are still spending too much money on stuff, in my opinion, that they don't need. This is what's the crux of this, isn't it?
Absolutely, but it's a very fine line to walk. People are now, people buying houses has diminished, people buying investment properties has gone down. You can't buy a new car these days because there's just none available. I mean, there's very few new cars that are available to buy. And so these things that people would normally be spending a large portion of their income on, they're not doing anymore, and they've still got that income, and so they're now spending it on other things that they want in their home or in their lives.
That's a very good point. I never thought of that. Oh, I was going to say, economists, are predicting, they say rates will peak at 4.35% and that inflation is flattening out, but still too high. They predict interest rates will not decline until 2024. That's a long time.
It is a long time. Inflation has now dropped down to 7%, but that's still a long way from our 2 to 3% range, range that the RBA has. Mm. So they have to at least halve or end a bit more yet. The inflation rate, it has to go from 7 back down to under 3%. So that's going to take, I think, a few more interest rise rises.
Yep. Yeah.
And so what I think is going to happen, they were increasing them monthly there for quite a while. We had no change last month, and then this month it's gone up. I think what's going to happen now is we will see them go from rises each month to a rise every second month.
Because in that, this 12th time you mentioned in 13 months, there was at one point in this calendar, let's say in the last 12 months, where they didn't actually rise at some point.
Last month, they didn't rise up last month.
Is that right? Okay.
They left it where it was last month. And a lot of publicists, a lot of the media, a lot of commentators came out last month when they didn't rise and said, woohoo, the roses are finished. It's all over. We can all, you know, start to settle down again
and spend more money.
I thought to myself at the time, there's no way this is over yet. You know, just hang on a bit, because it's a long way to get down to between 2-3% inflation from where we are. And it's fairly obvious that while inflation has started to fall, it's not falling fast enough or quickly enough to get to what we need to be in as quick as possible time. So I expect there will be 2-3 more interest rate rises this year, is my prediction. And we're probably going to end up, I think, it's now at 4.1%. I would not be at all surprised if we get up to around 4.7 or something, or 5% interest rates by the end of the year.
Yep. And, you know, you and I both have mortgages, and, you know, we're hurting. I know people say, oh, you own a house. But the thing is, this is also hurting tenants, because these owners who have tenants in their properties, they're passing at least some of this expense onto their tenants. And we have a rental crisis in the major cities in Australia, don't we?
Absolutely. Not only is there a minimum or a shortfall in available properties, but, you know, the economy, supply and demand is fairly basic to understand. And, you know, when supply drops, when demand increases and supply doesn't go with it, well, then the price increases. And so, yes, interest rate rises are impacting rents in some regard, and that rents are going up because of that. However, and I'm sure you don't fall into this category, Henry, as a landlord, but there are a certain number of landlords out there that are increasing rents higher than the inflation rate. Simply because they can, because they know that if they put it up $100 a week and the tenants move out, they know that within a week they'll have new tenants move in at the higher rate. There's a lot of profiteering going on with the rental market at the moment in Australia.
Absolutely. We have a small flat in King's Cross, and our tenant has been there for 4 years. And the agency that we use, the real estate agency that does all our stuff for us in King's Cross here in Sydney, they keep on saying to us, put the rent up. And we're just going, no. This tenant's been with us for nearly 4 years. We're not putting the rent up. And this is a place, as you were saying, Adam, this is a place, King's Cross is one of the most populated centres in a city in the country. And we could get a tenant the next day, no problem. But we're not doing it. Because
with a significant increase in the rent, you would still have a tenant the next day.
Yeah.
But, you know, Henry, what you've just explained is how the property market in Australia used to work 20 years ago. And that is, people bought an investment property, they rented it out, they got a good tenant, they left that tenant in there for as long as that tenant wanted to be there, as long as the rent was covering the mortgage and you know, any associated costs with it, then, you know, that was fine. That's all it needed to do. And then the investor made their money out of it at the end of the investment when they sold that property. Now, thanks to, and I track this back to our former Prime Minister John Howard. He was the one who instigated the huge spike in prices for properties, both investment and homes. I recall a very you know, proud John Howard on the news one night when he was Prime Minister saying, well, no one's complaining that the house value is going up. Meaning that, you know, people who own houses aren't complaining when they sell the house and it's gone up in value. Well, of course, no one's complaining about that.
Yeah.
But that set in play the actions which have resulted in the market that we've got today, where housing is out of reach to most people under the age of 50. Rental properties, if you can get one, they're hideously expensive and they're overpriced for what you're getting. And that's not just in Sydney or Melbourne or here in Brisbane. It's right across the country, in the regions, in the smaller cities. It's everywhere.
And
that's happened because as a nation, we've taken the lead from John Howard and we've gone, you know what, I'm not just going to put a tenant in this and let it sit there and then collect the capital gain when I sell the property. I want to make money off it right now. So up the rent as much as you can. Let's make as much money as we can out of this. Now, that's what's happening. There are some good tenants out there, like some good landlords like yourself. I know a couple of other landlords that I speak to on a regular basis, and they've said the same thing. They've got, you know, another friend of mine owns a property in Surry Hills in Sydney, and you know, it's 5 minutes walk to
the city.
CBD. To the city. Yeah. Yep, it's literally, you can see Central Train Station from their balcony. And they've had a tenant in it for years and years and years, and their agent says the same thing to them.
Yeah.
Put this rent up. This is ridiculous. We're going to make so much more money. And they're going, actually, we're actually providing a service here to people, and we want rents to be affordable. And I applaud that. So yeah, good on you.
Absolutely. And we must leave this subject in a minute. I just want to mention we've got listeners in the UK and, of course, North America. The Bank of England yet again hiked interest rates. Theirs is also the 12th consecutive, in their case, consecutive rise since December 21. This time the increase is same as ours today, 0.25 percentage points, taking their base rate to 4.5. In the United States, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System voted unanimously to raise the interest rate paid on reserve balances to 5.5% effective last May 4th, 2023. And just also to point out, it's the 10th time for them since March 22. And finally on this subject, the calls to the National Health Line, as in, I guess, mental health line, have increased by 30% since this, Adam.
Absolutely. Rental stress or mortgage stress, which is any person who's paying more than 30% of their income in rent or mortgage is officially in, you know, rental stress.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Perth, Hobart, all of these cities, Darwin as well. I'm not so sure about Adelaide, but I'd be surprised if it isn't. The vast majority of people paying rent are now paying much more than 30%. So, you know, this is a major, major issue. But I just want to remind you of something, Henry, from back in the 90s. Do you remember when interest rates were at 17 and 18?
Yes, under Paul Keating, the Prime Minister at the time. But, you know,
Of course, property values then were much lower than
I was just about to say that, because people talk about the 17% and, you know, the recession we had to have. I think Paul Keating was famous as a Prime Minister for saying that. But I've always pointed out to people that properties were much cheaper back then.
A 17% interest rate on a property worth $100,000 is much cheaper than a 5% interest rate by the time the bank takes their cut on a $1.4 million property.
Yeah, absolutely. From Sydney, Australia, Henry O'Donovan on Bondi Tunes International. If you've just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia, and I'm talking with our Australian political correspondent Adam Devlin in Brisbane in Queensland. Now, 1989. In 1989, Ayatollah Khomeini issued a fatwa condemning Salman Rushdie to death for alleged blasphemy in his novel The Satanic Verses. And then there was Tiananmen Square, remember that? The massacre in Beijing in 1989, which killed hundreds, if not thousands of people. We never got to find out. Also in 1989, I came to Australia and met this man called Adam Devlin. And also,
that's not all good news.
Also, it was all same kind of news. Also in 1989, Kathleen Folbig had her first child who died. Now, Kathleen Folbig was convicted for killing all four of her children between 89 and 99, with prosecutors alleging she smothered the infants. Adam, can you give us the backstory to this and the latest on Kathleen Folbig?
Just as you said, all four of her children died, two boys, two girls, and she was convicted of all four deaths and was convicted to prison for those four deaths. Now, she has always maintained her innocence. She has always said that she loved her children. She did not kill her children. She mourns her children. Like, she's been adamant this whole time that she didn't understand how these children died, but they weren't at her hand. Her husband divorced her, and he holds her responsible for the death of the four children.
Oh, really? I never knew about the husband. I've wondered about the husband.
Yeah, and in fact, I read an article today, an interview with him, where he says his opinion on the deaths of his four children have not changed. He draws attention to the fact that she has been pardoned, but she has not been acquitted, and that the charges still stand against her. So he is taking the stance that until she is acquitted, until her conviction is quashed, and that then he will hold her responsible for the deaths of his four children. Now, there's been a campaign pretty much since the day she was jailed to get a review into her case. There were several appeals, of which all of them she lost. And eventually, through the campaigning of one of her closest friends, a lady by the call of by the name of Tracy Chapman.
Yes, and not the singer.
Not the singer.
You were going to say that.
they've just continued to put pressure on the New South Wales judicial system and on the parliament in New South Wales to get this looked at again and again and again. The parliament and the judicial system have pretty much wiped its hands of her and said, look, you know, we've done everything we can do. Everything's, you know, we have no reason to believe she did not kill her children, so therefore she's in jail for 25 years. Now,
I thought it was 20 years. She got off after 20 years. I get it.
Yeah, she's now been pardoned and released after 20 years. She still has 5 years left of her sentence.
Yep, got you.
Now, some evidence has been some research has been done, and a while ago it was discovered that Kathleen Velbeck has a genetic mutation in her body, in her genes, and the particular genetic mutation that she has, and I'm not even going to try and pronounce it because I can't. But essentially, what it does is it turns off the hormone that regulates the heartbeat, and so it's incredibly rare. And Kathleen has this, and they've discovered that her two daughters also had this mutation in their genes. And so that alone creates significant reasonable doubt. This disorder, this genetic disorder mutation, can just stop your heart from beating.
Gosh.
If your heart doesn't beat, you die.
Yeah, good
And point. There's no symptoms. There's no, like, there's nothing
so you
else.
You can't see it coming.
No.
I just want to put an audio grab in here. She actually hired a PR company to record. For the first time, she went on video, and Channel 9 in Australia, the Nine Network, got exclusive rights to what her first words in public since she was freed, only about 30 hours ago. Take a listen to Kathleen Folbig.
Hello, this is Kathleen. I'm extremely humbled and extremely grateful for being pardoned and released from prison. My eternal gratitude goes to my friends and family, especially Tracy and all of her family, and I would not have survived this whole ordeal without them. Today is a victory for science and especially truth. And for the last 20 years I have been in prison, I have forever and will always think of my children, grieve for my children, and have missed them and loved them terribly. Thank you.
Okay, she sounds very sprightly. And, you know, we talked off air about this. She has no hatred, she said in a statement, over her treatment. Tell me about this.
That is an amazing place for her to land, to not hate the people who did this to her. But it's very healthy as well, I have to say.
She seems remarkably forgiving, in my view.
Well, I would have thought after 20 years you would be sitting in jail going, I'm here for my whole sentence.
Yes.
Like, I'm not, I'm simply going to serve out my sentence and then be released of a crime I did not do. So the fact that here she is, four-fifths of the way through her sentence, and she finally gets pardoned and released, I think the predominant feeling at this point for her would be one of relief.
I was going to say relief as well.
And hatred is such a negative, all-consuming emotion that it if you can avoid hatred in any aspect of your life, do it, because there's no positive side to hating someone or something. And so I don't know the woman. I've never spoken to the woman. I've got nothing to do with the woman. I can only assume that she, in her 20 years in jail for something she didn't do, that she has got to a point of she's worked her way through the hate.
Yes, good point. She's had plenty of time.
And I presume that underneath her relief, once that passes, I hope that she gets to a point of anger and not a point of hatred. Because anger can drive you to pursue justice. It can drive you to pursue compensation. It can drive you to pursue the righting of the wrongs that have been done against her. Hatred will never do that. Yes. Hate won't get you to those places. Anger will.
I just want to say, you know, as we've talked about, no hatred over her treatment, but describe the ordeal she had faced was unimaginable. And by the way, apparently she was put into solitary confinement at one point. I mean, I don't know why that is.
Well, there's a certain sisterhood in female jails around women who kill their children. So I can presume, again, it's a presumption, but I assume that she was put into isolation or solitary confinement for her own protection.
Yeah.
Because as a convicted killer of her own four children, there would have been, I can only imagine, a number of people that she was sharing that jail with that would have had no second thought about causing her harm.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about it is, I just find this very sad because at the same time she was thrown unceremoniously into jail, she was grieving over four children who died. I mean, that's a double whammy, isn't it?
And to then be accused of their death and sentenced and she's lost her marriage over this. She's lost her career over this. She's lost 20 years of her life over this. She's lost friendships. She's become infamous in this country for something she did not do. Now, I don't know how somebody gets to a point where they're okay with all of that. I don't know if I have the fortitude within my soul to be able to deal with all of that and come out of it and not be vengeful.
Yeah, 20 years is a long time, but let's bear in mind also that she's 54 years old. She's got another couple of maybe three decades of her life. I mean, that's, you know, at least she's got that. It's not like, you know, a lot of these prisoners who get out of prison in their 70s and 80s. She's still relatively young, you know?
True, but let's not forget, she's lost 20 years of her career. Who's going to employ a 55-year-old woman with no experience and no background?
Yes,
She's lost 20 years of superannuation. She will have no retirement savings. So I only hope that this poor woman sues the New South Wales government for every penny she can get out of them in compensation.
Yes, and that was my next question. I mean, her legal team will decide on what type of compensation she should seek. Her lawyer... what's that noise?
Sorry, my headphones fell off.
Okay.
There are two forms of compensation she can pursue here. One is an ex gratia payment, where she can apply for an ex gratia payment and the government just agrees to pay it and it's the end of the story. The other is she sues the government for compensation, and that's a court case where her legal team will put a claim into the court saying, we want X millions of dollars worth of compensation, and that figure is made up of the following. Lost income, pain and suffering, lost superannuation, compensation for the loss of her marriage, compensation for the grieving that she had to do in jail over the death of her four children that we now know she did not kill, and interest on all of that. So, you know, if you consider it, the average income now is around close to 100 grand. So there's 2 million straight away just in lost salary. Then you've got the superannuation component of that and lost interest over 20 years, which needs to be calculated and then added to. And then there's the pain and suffering compensation, the stuff that you, that's very difficult to put a dollar price on.
Of course,
but she has every right to pursue those in the court, and I hope she does.
And this will take time. But, you know, one would assume, although, you know, you and I, when we're telemarketers, our manager told us never to assume anything, makes an ass of you and me. But one would assume that this will be a good payout and she'll never have to work a day in her life again.
I agree, and nor should she have to.
Yes.
I would expect, just on a very loose, unsophisticated back of the envelope calculation that I did today, I would expect her compensation payment to be something in the rounds of $15 to $20 million.
Okay. From Brisbane, Australia, Adam Devlin on iTunes International. If you have just joined us, this is Bondi Tunes International. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia, and I've got our Australian political correspondent Adam Devlin joining me from Brisbane in the state of Queensland. Now, I don't know where to start with this one. Former SAS soldier Ben Robert Smith was not an honest and reliable witness in parts of his marathon defamation case against Nine newspapers. Here in Australia, a federal court has found. Adam, can you break down the details of this case for us?
Sure. Ben Robert Smith is one of our most awarded and famous soldiers. He has the Victoria Cross, which is the highest honour we give. Mm-hmm. And this came around his service in Afghanistan. And in 2009, where several of his co-soldiers, people who were serving with him, either, you know, in other what are the groups called? The group of soldiers, other...
I don't know. I know nothing about war. I know nothing about the army.
It's, other groups of soldiers who saw things that he was doing, and people serving directly under him, so his subordinates, made official complaints about the behaviour that he was displaying whilst in Afghanistan. Mm. Now, there was an internal investigation done, and he was cleared of any wrongdoing. And some of these soldiers, some of them were victimised personally by him, others witnessed what he was doing, and they went to the media and they gave affidavits to the Nine media and Chris Masters and a couple of other journalists, and a story was published airing these grievances, airing these accusations. Mm. Now, Ben Robert Smith then decided that he would sue these papers for defamation, saying that he'd been cleared in an inquiry and that these claims were utterly false, and that his reputation had been destroyed by these accusations. Mm. So a very lengthy, very expensive defamation case started.
Over now, a long period of time, Adam.
Yes, absolutely. One of the longest in Australia. Mm. But I just need to say here, this defamation case is a civil case. Mm. Sorry, I've got the hiccups now.
No, that's okay. Well, you know what? I was a newsreader and I got the hiccups on air, live on radio, which was not fun and very embarrassing. And by the way, you know, Ben Robert Smith, I think, got Father of the Year. I mean, he was kind of like a god in Australia.
I also think he got Australian of the Year.
Oh, probably.
So he then decided to sue for defamation. Now, that case is a civil case. It's not a criminal case. Mm. So, and he was very determined and very sort of proud of the fact that he would turn up and he would defend himself and he would be cleared of these allegations.
Yeah.
And he would then claim a massive amount of compensation off the Nine media group. Mm-hmm. So the case happened. It went to court. He gave his evidence. He was cross-examined. And most of the evidence that he presented collapsed under cross-examination.
Right.
Basically, at the end of the trial, and I'm cutting a very long story short here,
yeah,
but
sure.
Basically at the end of the trial, the judge said that that Ben Robert Smith was not a reliable witness. And he came on, and he then went on to say, and this is I just want to mention a couple of these quotes from the judge, if I may.
Sure.
Ben Robert Smith, while a member of the Special Air Services Regiment, murdered an unarmed and defenseless Afghani civilian named Ali Jan by kicking him off a cliff and procuring the soldiers under his command to shoot him. Mm-hmm. He broke the moral and legal right of military engagement and therefore is a criminal. These are the words of the judge of this case, by the way, not my opinion.
Yes, yes.
Mr. Robert Smith disgraced his country and the Australian Army by his conduct as a member of the SASR in Afghanistan. While a member of the SASR, Mr. Robert Smith committed murder by pressuring a newly deployed and inexperienced SASR soldier to execute an elderly unarmed Afghan in order to, and I quote, blood the rookie. Now, I find that term rather repulsive.
Mm.
Mr. Robert Smith committed murder by machine gunning a man who had a prosthetic leg at the Whiskey 108 compound. Having murdered the disabled man with a machine gun, Mr. Robert Smith was also callous and inhumane that he brought that he took the prosthetic leg back to Australia and encouraged his soldiers to use it as a novelty beer drinking vessel.
Yes.
Mr. Robert Smith, as Deputy Commander of the 2009 SASR Patrol, authorised the execution of an unarmed Afghan by a junior trooper in his patrol. During the course of, and I'm nearly done here, but during the course of his 2010 deployment in Afghanistan, Mr. Robert Smith bashed an unarmed Afghan in the face with his fists and in the stomach with his knee, and in so doing alarmed two patrol commanders to the extent that they ordered him to back off.
Is the judge saying, confirming that this happened?
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly what the judge said.
A lot of people don't understand the fact that it was Ben Robert Smith going against, the government, I guess, or the army. It wasn't the other way around. A lot of people think he was on trial, but sorry, I'm talking about the media. The media were on trial, not him. A lot of people don't realise this.
No, a lot of people think this is a witch hunt against him. Mm. And I've had to spell out to numerous people, he instigated this court case. This was his doing.
Yes.
And
he shot himself in the foot with this, excuse the pun.
Excuse the rather unfortunate pun, yes.
Yes. probably yes, unnecessary. Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. He brought this on. Mm. He was so confident in his ability to lie about what he'd done that he thought he could stand up and survive cross-examination. Mm. And clearly, as soon as he started to be cross-examined, his story fell apart.
Gosh, I wonder what he's thinking, you know, like...
And in fact, what actually surfaced at one point was evidence that suggested that he had been grooming people, his witnesses, that he had been grooming them on what to say and how to say it.
Well, what happens next with this? These things never bloody end. Because isn't over.
This is a civil case, as I said.
Yeah, so what about the criminal case?
So what will happen now is this will be, I imagine, referred to the Director of Public Prosecutions.
Mm.
It may be referred to the court-martial arm of the Australian Armed Forces. And what I expect to happen is there will be a new trial where he will be charged with war crimes. And that trial will, run its course. And we will have a verdict at the end of that as to whether he is a war criminal or not.
Yeah.
Based on the findings of the judge in this defamation case, it would be very difficult for him to present evidence in a criminal case that would support his assertions that he didn't do this stuff.
Okay, we must leave it there, but I just want to mention, which you'll find quite funny, or maybe not. Your headphones are okay?
I have to buy new ones. They just keep falling off.
Falling off your head.
I'm very lazy.
Okay. Now, look, just worth mentioning, Oscar Wilde sued someone, I don't know who, and not since Oscar Wilde sued someone, I don't know who, has this happened where he lost and ended up in jail. That's the last time this happened, apparently.
Yeah. Well, look, not only will Ben Robert Smith potentially end up in jail, all of his medals will be revoked. His portrait that hangs in the National War Memorial in Canberra will be taken down. There are numerous monuments to him around the country. They will all be taken down.
Yes.
His reputation is now in tatters. And the population of Australia are slowly but surely coming to realise that this war hero is actually a war criminal.
Yeah, okay.
And he will be, I assume, based on the evidence that came forth in this civil case, he will be our second serving member of the military to be convicted on war crimes.
Right. And he won't be Father of the Year or Australian of the Year anytime soon again.
But he may be cellmate of the year, depending on how things go when he's on the inside.
Okay, now, just before we go, we were talking about Kathleen Folbig, talking for the first time today about her 20 years in jail of a 25-year sentence. One thing I just want to end up on with regard to Kathleen Folbig is that she came out and joined her friend in her house, her country farm, and she had to learn about streaming media and smartphones and television.
Yeah.
Because she hadn't seen all this stuff.
Exactly. And this is one of the things that she needs to claim compensation for. She's been removed from the world, from her life, locked up for 20 years for something she didn't do. And she's now been just tossed back out into the community. Hello, in the last 20 years, we've had such phenomenal change, social change, technological change, economic change, geopolitical change. She's basically been thrown back into a community she no longer understands.
Yeah, it must be very strange. You see this kind of stuff in movies, someone's been in a coma for 20 years and they come out and they don't know what a mobile phone is kind of thing.
Exactly. Imagine trying to explain TikTok to her.
Oh, dear. I don't even understand TikTok.
I don't get TikTok.
I don't want to know about TikTok.
Imagine trying to explain cryptocurrency to her.
Oh, dear. She's got a lot to learn, doesn't she?
Yeah, online shopping
would
be new to her.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. And I'm sure her best, she's her best friend, Tracy Chapman, not the singer, will help her. And they're having a great time, having a couple of drinks and sitting beside the pool. And it's a beautiful thing. Adam, thank you so much for your time here on Bondi Tunes.
Been a pleasure, and we'll talk soon. Cheers, mate.
This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio.
From Leicester, the United Kingdom.
Hi, this is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with Tony Manta. He's a musician, singer, songwriter, producer, and manager of Plateau Music, courtesy of Livewire. How are you, Tony?
I'm doing great, thanks.
You have so much knowledge on music. I'm very interested to know which singer you have chosen to talk about today, and what song have you picked?
Okay, all right, the song that I picked is a song that was written back in 1961, and it was written by a Belgian poet-composer by the name of Jacques Brel, and he did it, the original title was Le Moribond, which I think translates into The Dying Man, and the way that he wrote this song, it was rather macabre. It dealt with an older man dying saying goodbye to his priest and his best friend and his wife, who had been cheating on him with his best friend. So it became quite a hit, and this man has written many songs that have been re-recorded by very well-known people like Ray Charles and John Denver, Judy Collins. He influenced David Bowie. He was quite the composer and songwriter. But the interesting part on this is that an American poet by the name of Rod McEwen actually translated the lyrics of the song into English. And in 1964, the Kingston Trio released the first English language version of this song. And it was a minor hit, you know, it did well for him. And then the singer that wound up releasing it in 1973 and then it peaked in 1974, he was actually hearing the Kingston Trio's version of it. And he decided that he wanted to make some changes. So the irony of this whole song is that it started out with the Belgian poet writing the song. And then because the American poet rewrote it, he became a part writer of the song. And then the last singer that recorded it, that made it a huge hit, rewrote it, added another verse to it, but never thought that it was going to do that good, so he never took any writing credits. And the amazing part of it is that it sold like it. This singer songwriter was a artist in Canada.
Yeah.
And he had done a few things with his family and everything, and had some hit records, minor hit records out there, and then he released this on his own label, and it became the biggest selling single in Canada. It just went crazy, and then it crossed over into the United States, and it went huge there, selling more than 3 million copies. And then it went into the UK, and it became a huge hit over there, and then worldwide it sold over 6 million copies. So it became a huge hit record, and so this singer-songwriter was working with the Beach Boys.
Yeah.
And he heard this Kingston Trio version of it, and he thought that this would be a great song for the Beach Boys. So he started working with the Beach Boys on it, and they took in and actually started some production and started really working on it. But then and they had Carl Wilson of the Beach Boys singing the lead. And then it became a problem because Brian Wilson started getting involved and wanted to take over the production, and they started going back and forth and wanted to take control. And ultimately, the singer decided to leave. So he left, and it never got finished. So then, and part of the reason why that I chose this song is because I was going to Berklee College of Music in Boston in 1973. And this song was just released, and I'd heard it a few times, and I just loved the song. And when I heard it, I never really truly listened to the lyrics. It was more about the music at that point. I really liked the music. I liked the flow of it. I liked the way they put it together. So I decided to mark it as one of my favorite, and I actually performed it with my band because it was so good. And then one time I got a chance to, I was working on a show, and I actually got a chance to meet the singer of the record that made it a huge hit. And we just got talking, and then he told me a little bit about the background of it, you know, with the way it was translated and how morbid it was on this man was gonna kill himself, and it was just really quite interesting. So he had heard it, and he rewrote it because he had a friend of his that he'd found out that was dying of cancer. And so at that point in time, he decided that he had to take and change it a little bit and kind of rework it, and he did. So he reworked it to the point of where it became a major hit, like I said, in Canada, and then a major company in the U.S. went over to Canada and signed him so that they could release it in the U.S. It became a big hit there, and then the U.K. And it just turned out to be such a monster song. It dealt with basically the singer saying that, you know, he had to say goodbye to some of his friends because his friend was dying, and he just wanted to make sure that he got the point across that this was, you know, important to him. So he put it all together and he laid it down and got it going, and not knowing what it would become. And it just became so huge for the singer that releasing it in 1973. And he was in a group called the Poppy Family, and they had a number two hit record back in the 70s, and they had two or three others that got up in the top 40s. And then he decided to take this song and really make it his own. And he had got a chance to meet with the original writer.
Yeah.
And got a chance to talk to him, and so right before the release of the song in 73, the original writer retired, and no one could understand why, you know, and they found out 6 years later that he had cancer himself, and he died in 1978. So he never really got a chance to relish, you know, all the success of the song with the last singer that recorded it, because he was fighting cancer, you know. So it was kind of a sad situation, you know, for both of them. But the name of the song, which I'm sure everybody once they hear this, you know, will know it. And now, hopefully, you know, they're going to hear this song, and now that they know the true story behind it and how it transitioned from a very sad ballad to a translated song for the Kingston Trio, and then ultimately the singer out of Canada re-recorded it, added a verse to it, and wound up selling, like I said, over 6 million copies worldwide. It just made life change for him, because it changed his life to the point of where he became an environmentalist and started you know, working different things that he wanted to do and trying to help people. And he's still alive today, sings it every now and then.
Do you know him directly? Really, do you know him directly?
I met him one time. At the show. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, really nice guy. And he was just a real humble, real just a genuinely guy that you would want to know, because he was just he cared about the environment, he cared about people, you know, he cared about a lot of people, you know, and a lot of things, and tried to help people, and just a really truly nice guy. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. So you couldn't ask for a better person to actually get this. Get this song, get this recognition, because of everything he'd done. He took and did good with it. If you go back and you look at the version that the original songwriter wrote, it is very dark. You know, it's about dying, but it's a very dark, you know, way that he puts it across. Whereas with the way that the last singer that rewrote it and did it, it was kind of about a friend of his that was dying, you know, but and it was saying goodbye to people, but it was done in such a way that it kind of can pull at your heartstrings, but it can still make you feel good because of the music and the way that it was all put together. With the way that he had wrote it and composed it and arranged it and produced it, if you really listen to it, you know, it makes you think about life. You know, I mean, it makes you think about your father. It makes you think about friends, because mm-hmm. that's what he tried to do. Because, you know, it's like if anybody's lost their parents, you know, and they hear that, you know, that's the first thing they think about. Oh, you know, and the same thing with any other friends that you might have. You know, he wrote it and put it together and arranged it in such a great, awesome way that it touches on sadness, but it does it in such a way that it might make you feel a little bit sad, but in a good way. He made a lot of money off of it, but he turned around and gave it back to a lot of people and helped people. So a really good guy. So once people hear this song and remember it, I'm hoping that now they're going to kind of look at it a little bit differently, and they might be able to, you know, look it up and do a little bit more research on it, because there's just so much more about how he had took and changed his life and did things for people in Canada and just did so many things. And they can look up and see his history of his music and how he performed and had some minor hits and then all of a sudden he had this big hit. And the singer is Terry Jacks, and this big hit is called Seasons in the Sun.
Fantastic. It's a lovely song. And thank you so much for coming.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend. We've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, pretty girls are everywhere. Think of me and I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the hills that we climbed were just seasons out of time. Goodbye, Papa, please pray for me. I was the black sheep of the family. You tried to teach me right from wrong. Too much wine and too much song. Wonder how I got along. Goodbye, Papa, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, little children everywhere, when you see them, I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the wine and the song, like the seasons, have all gone. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the wine and the song, like the seasons, have all gone. Goodbye, Michelle, my little one. You gave me love and helped me find the sun. Every time that I was down, you would always come around and get my feet back on the ground. Goodbye, Michelle, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, with the flowers everywhere, that we could both be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the stars we could reach were just starfish on the beach. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun, but the stars we could reach were just starfish on the beach. We had joy, we
This is Ling Pang for Bonang Tunes International, and I talked with Tony Manta.
Victims we know so well, they shine in your eyes when they kiss and tell. Strange places we never see, but you're always there, like a ghost in my dream. And I keep on telling you, please don't do the things you do. When you do those things, pull my puppet strings, have the strangest void for you. We love and we never tell what places our hearts in the wishing well. Love leads us into the stream, and it sink or swim like it's always been. And I keep on loving you, it's the only thing to do. When the angel sings, there are greater things. Can I give them all? Take a ride into unknown pleasure. Feel like a child on a dark night, wishing there was some kind of heaven. I could be warm with your smiling. Put out your hand for a while. The victims, we know them so well, so well.
The sun never sets. on Bondi Tunes.